And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hodnell. This is the Ken Hodnell Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, we should be seeing the COVID-19 vaccinations shortly. Moderna's vaccine was approved, as was Pfizer's. Today is December 18th, 352nd day of the year. Leap year is 353rd. 13 days remain till this year's over with. On this date in history, in 218 BC, during the Second Punic War, the Battle of Trebia, Hannibal's Carthaginian forces defeat those of the Roman Republic. 1271, Kublai Khan renames his empire Yuan, officially marking the start of the Yuan dynasty of Mongolian China. 1499, a rebellion breaks out in Alpujarras in response to the forced conversion of Muslims in Spain. 1622, Portuguese forces score a military victory over the Kingdom of Congo at the Battle of Mbambi in present-day Angola. 1655, the Whitehall Conference ends with the determination there's actually no law prohibiting Jews from reentering England after the Edict of Expulsion in 1290. 1777, the U.S. celebrates its first Thanksgiving, marking the recent victory by the American rebels over British General John Burgoyne at Saratoga in October. 1787, New Jersey becomes the third state to ratify the Constitution. 1793, surrender the frigate La Lutine by the French royalists to Lord Hood. It was renamed HMS Lutine, later became a very famous treasure wreck. 1833, the national anthem of the Russian Empire, God Save the Tsar, is first performed. 1854, the Legislative Assembly of the Province of Canada abolishes the seigneurial system. That began in France, where big sections of land known as manors were given to nobles, and those nobles actually controlled not only the land but the people on it. And they did away with it. 1865. U.S. Secretary of State William Seward proclaims the adoption of the 13th Amendment, which prohibited slavery throughout the U.S. The ...1878, the Al-Thani family becomes the rulers of the state of Qatar. 1892, the premiere performance of The Nutcracker by Tchaikovsky took place in St. Petersburg, Russia. 1898, Gaston de Chasseloup-Laubat sets the first officially recognized land speed record of 63.159 kilometers per hour. That was 39.245 miles per hour in a Jean Todt electric car. 1900, the Upper Fern Tree Gully to Gambrook, Victoria Narrow Gauge Railway, which was 2.6 inches wide. Now the Puffing Billy Railway in Victoria, Australia is open for traffic. If you didn't mind being closed in. 1916, World War I. Battle of Verdun ends with the second French offensive pushes the German back 2 to 3 kilometers. That made them stop their attacks. 1917, a resolution containing the language of the 18th Amendment to enact prohibitions passed by the U.S. Congress. The religious fanatics gained control. They were going to do away with demon rum. And all they did was make multimillionaires out of some crooks. 1932, the Chicago Bears defeat the Portsmouth Spartans in the NFL playoff game to win the first NFL playoff game to win the NFL championship. 1935, the Lanka Sama Samaja Party is founded in Ceylon. 1939, World War II, the Battle of Heligoland Bight, the first major air battle of the war, takes place. 20th Bomber Command responds to the Japanese Operation Ichigo offensive by dropping 500 tons of incendiary bombs on a supply base in Hankou, China. 1958, Project SCORE, the world's first communication satellite, is launched. 1966, Saturn's moon Epimetheus is discovered by astronomer Richard Walker. 1972, Vietnam War. President Nixon announces the U.S. will engage in North Vietnam in Operation Linebacker 2. That was a series of Christmas bombings after peace talks collapsed with North Vietnam on the 13th of December. 1973, Soviet Soyuz program. Soyuz 13, crewed by cosmonauts Valentin Lebedev and Peter Klemuk, is launched from Baikonur in the Soviet Union. 1977, United Airlines Flight 2860 crashes near Kaysville, Utah. All three crew members on board die. 1981, the first flight of the Russian heavy strategic bomber, the Tu-160. The world's largest combat aircraft, the largest supersonic aircraft, and the largest variable sweep-wing aircraft ever built. 1999, NASA launches into orbit the Terra platform carrying five Earth observation instruments, including the Aster, the Ceres, the Messier, the MODIS, and the MOPET. 2002, California gubernatorial recall. Then-Governor of California, Gray Davis, announces the state would face a record budget deficit of $35 billion, roughly double the figure reported during his reelection campaign just a month before. 2005, the Chadian Civil War begins with rebel groups allegedly backed by neighboring Sudan launching an attack in Aceh. 2006, the first of a series of floods strikes Malaysia. The death toll of all that flooding is at least 118. Over 400,000 people lose their homes. 2006, United Arab Emirates holds its first ever elections. 2015, the Killingly Colliery, the last deep coal mine in Great Britain, closes down. 2017, Amtrak Cascades Passenger Train 501, which is derailed near DuPont, Washington, a city in near Olympia, Washington. The derailment kills 6 and injures 70 others. 2018, list of bolides. A meteor exploded over the Bering Sea with a force of 10 times greater than the atomic bomb that destroyed Hiroshima in 1945. And in 2019, U.S. House of Representatives votes in support of the impeachment of Donald Trump. Excuse me. That was a waste of time and money, that impeachment process. Holidays and observances: Christian Feast Day, Expectation of the Blessed Virgin Mary, Flanan, Gatanius of Tours, O Adonai, Our Lady of Expectation, Sebastian in the Eastern Orthodox Church, Winibald, International Migrants Day. There's enough of those. In Qatar, we have National Day. In Niger, we have Republic Day. And in the United Nations, we have UN Arabic Language Day. Well, let's see what else we got. All right. 1352, Etienne Albert, elected as Pope Innocentius VI. 1385, the Peace of Tournai, signed between the Burgundian Duke Philip II and rebellious city of Ghent. 1603, the first fleet of the Dutch East India Company under Admiral Stephen van der Hagen departs for the East Indies. 1621, the English Parliament accepts unanimously protestation. 1642, Abel Tasman's expedition sails around Farewell Spit and into Golden Bay, the first sighting of the local Maori in New Zealand. 1719, Thomas Fleet publishes Mother Goose's Melodies for Children. 1773, a skirmish at Grass Cove in Queen Charlotte Sound results in the death of two Moirai and nine members of James Cook's expedition in New Zealand. The Moirai were such fierce warriors that even when shot, they didn't always go down. That's why the 45 was developed. The larger round of the 45 caliber had enough power to put them down permanently. 1774, Empress Maria Theresa expels Jews from Prague, Bohemia, and Moravia. 1783, King George III dismisses the Duke of Portland's government. He wasn't happy with what was going on. 1799, on this date, George Washington's body was buried at Mount Vernon. 1813, British take Fort Niagara in the War of 1812. 1832, the HMS Beagle, with Charles Darwin on board, reaches Tierra del Fuego for the first time. 1839, the first celestial photograph of the moon made in the U.S. by John Draper in New York City. 1849, William Bond obtains the first photograph of the moon through a telescope. 1852, George Hamilton Gordon becomes the Prime Minister of the UK after the downfall of the Conservative government of Edward Smith Stanley. 1862, the battle at Lexington, Tennessee. That was General Nathan Bedford Forrest's second raid. 1865, the first U.S. cattle importation laws passed. 1867, 49 victims of Angola Horror train wreck burned to death in Angola, New York. 1878, the French SS Byzantin sinks after colliding in the Dardanelles. 210 people die. 1878, John Kehoe, the last of the Molly Maguires, is executed in Pennsylvania. 1888, Richard Rethero and his brother-in-law discovered the ancient Anasazi ruins of Mesa Verde, Colorado. 1890, Lugard's expedition to Ming and Kampala, Uganda. 1899, Field Marshal Lord Roberts appointed British Supreme Commander in South Africa. 1902, the British Parliament passes the Education Act, which would be known as the would be regarded as the most important legislation of his time in government. 1912, the Piltdown Man, later discovered to be a hoax, is supposedly found in the Piltdown Gravel Pit by Charles Dawson. 1913, the Indian Inquiry Commission, also known as the Solomon Commission, commences its deliberations in Pretoria. 1916, the Battle of Verdun, the longest of World War I. Officially ends in a German defeat after 9 months of fighting and almost 1 million total casualties. 1917, the Soviet government issues a decree recognizing Finland's newly declared independence. 1920, the first U.S. postage stamp was printed without the words United States or U.S. on it. 1923, International Zone of Tangiers set up in Morocco. 1935, Edward Beneš becomes president of Czechoslovakia. 1939, the Finnish army recaptures Aglajavari. 1941, a German submarine, the U-434, sinks. 41 also, Japanese troops land on Hong Kong. 1944, the U.S. destroyers, the Hull, the Spence, and the Monahan sink during a typhoon in the Philippines. 1944, Nazi occupiers of Amsterdam destroy the electricity plants. 1946, TV's first network dramatic serial called Faraway Hill ends a two-month run in the U.S. That was the first time we had a continuing dramatic series. 1956, To Tell the Truth debuts on CBS TV. That was a very long-running show. 1957, the world's first full-scale nuclear power plant for only peacetime use begins to generate electricity at the Shippingport Atomic Power Station in Pennsylvania. 1960, a general meeting of the UN condemns apartheid, which was being practiced in South Africa. 1962, the USSR performs a nuclear test at Savaya Zemla in Russia. 1963, the Pink Panther film premieres. This is directed by Blake Edwards, starred Peter Sellers and David Niven. Henry Mancini wrote the unforgettable tunes. And in 64, the Pink Panther cartoon series premiered. 1964, during a funeral service held for soul singer Sam Cooke, fans caused damage to the funeral home. 1964, the U.S. performs a nuclear test at the Nevada test site. Downwind of that was a movie being made starring John Wayne. He eventually died of cancer. 1965, Frank Borman and Jim Lovell splash down in the Atlantic after a two-week Gemini 7 mission. And an important milestone, 1966, on this date, Dr. Seuss, How the Grinch Stole Christmas, airs for the first time on CBS. 1969, on this date, the House of Lords votes to abolish the death penalty for England, Wales, and Scotland. Didn't happen in Northern Ireland until July 25th, 1973. 1971, CBS Radio canceled its Saturday morning band concerts, which had been a staple. 1971, three members of the IRA die when the bomb they were transporting explodes prematurely in King Street, Magara Felt, in County Derry. 1976, Wonder Woman debuted on ABC. 1984, Christmas Carol, directed by Clive Donner, starring George C. Scott, premiered in the U.S. on this date. 1984, Christmas Carol, directed by Clive Donner, starring George C. Scott, premiered in the U.S. on this date. And Dr. McCoy on the USS Enterprise got a star in Hollywood on this date in 1991. His name was DeForest Kelly. Unfortunately, he is dead. I met all the main actors except DeForest Kelly at Comic-Cons, where I've made my books available. My 100th book is now finished. I haven't published it yet. 1994, the Socialist Party wins Bulgaria parliamentary election. In 1996, the Oakland, how left can we go, California School Board passes a resolution officially declaring Ebonics a language or a dialect. In 2002, fashion designer Calvin Klein announces he's selling his company to shirt maker Phillips Van Heusen for $430 million. I'd have sold it for half that. In 2009, James Cameron's Avatar, which is a fascinating film, starring Sam Worthington, Zoe Saldana, and Sigourney Weaver, was released in the U.S. on this date, becomes the highest-grossing film of all time. I heard him speak in Las Vegas. Interesting person to listen to. 2012, six health workers dispensing polio vaccinations are gunned down in Pakistan. The belief was by many people that the vaccination actually caused the disease. 2012, the Salika Rebel Coalition kills 15 people during its capture of Bria, the Central African Republic. Well, we've come to the end of our history session. We've been talking about serial killers. And right now, we're talking about Edmund Kemper. Well, he wanted to experience things he hadn't experienced before. And everybody likes to experience new feelings, particularly teenagers, simply because by that point in their life, they haven't experienced much. They want to feel what it's like to kiss somebody or fall in love, maybe drive a car. But at the age of 15, Edmund Emil Kemper had a new experience. He killed his grandparents because he wanted to know what it felt like. During his 70s, he prowled Santa Cruz, California, and got the feelings of adding some more folks to his kill list. Six co-eds, his mother and his mother's best friend. And what he did to the bodies was indescribable. Now, his background was what you see over and over again in serial and mass murderous childhoods. It was chaos and abuse, and his parents were cruel in the extreme, physically and verbally. They didn't go by that one or both of them didn't verbally tear into him for his inadequacies or punish him in some way. One example from his childhood is a clear illustration. As a punishment, his mother made him kill his pet chicken, and then his dad made him eat it. Now, as a young boy, he gave hints that the treatment by his parents were creating a deranged personality. He had a habit, for example, of taking his sister's dolls, decapitating them, and amputating their arms and legs. And after a while, the dolls didn't satisfy him, so dogs and cats in that neighborhood would suffer the same fate. Now, his size would have allowed him to play with the National Football League. He was 6'9", weighed 280 pounds. And this wasn't flab. One point during his heyday, he hung around a bar in Santa Cruz called the Jury Room across the street from the courthouse. Now, this bar was patronized by lots of police officers, and some of them were actually on the task force charged with finding the so-called co-ed killer. And Kemper used to delight the patrons by grabbing 200-pound officers by the elbows and hoisting them over his head. He didn't appear harmful, though. He wore glasses, had a face that was quite ordinary. Indeed, he appeared professorial. One physical trait that apparently bothered him was the small size of his equipment, so to speak. According to John Goodwin in his book, Murder USA, the way We Kill Each Other, Kemper was driven by manic sex urges, but saddled with a crippling sense of inferiority. Due to his size, his equipment appeared small, and he was quite inept as a lover. As well as being physically imposing, he was smart. And it was his cunning that let him walk the streets despite having killed his grandparents. After those murders, for 5 years, he was in the Atascadero Hospital for mental treatment. When he turned 20, no fewer than 19 doctors there pronounced him sane and released him. He was a good listener, and he likely listened to whomever he could to learn what response his behavior evidenced a healthy personality. In fact, it's easy to imagine a guy as smart as Kemper spouting such appropriate responses and aping the healthy behavior of others to fool the experts. Well, Santa Cruz was a lazy California town known mostly for the University of Southern California campus loaded with pretty young girls. Well, in the fall of 1970, co-eds started disappearing. When they reappeared, well, suffice it to say, they weren't all there. According to John Goodwin in his book, Murder USA, the bleached skull of Marianne Pesky lay in a wooded mountain ravine. The torso of Cynthia Shaw, minus arms and legs, was washed up on a Monterey beach. And the bodies of Rosalind Thorpe and Alice Liu, their heads and both of Alice's hands missing, were uncovered by road workers in Alameda County. Occasionally, unidentifiable scraps would turn up. A woman's hand without fingers, a female pelvic bone, one breast. Later, authorities would learn that Kemper was a cannibal as well as a necrophiliac. And that accounted for quite a number of the missing body parts. With the exception of one case in which he raped a girl as she lay dying, he would have sex with his victims only after they were dead. However, he was more prone to engage in sex with parts of the body. One favorite sexual activity of Kemper was to take a victim's head into the shower with him and enjoy himself with that. And he made sure all the circumstances were right before he'd select a victim. Generally, he'd pick up co-eds in his car as they hitchhiked down Ashby Avenue. He used maps to plot places where he'd take his victims, and he'd had a supply of plastic bags with him for the body parts that he'd cut off and use for his later pleasure. He would describe later the intense sexual pleasure he got from devouring large hunks of flesh from his victims. Well, 1972, a couple of years after the mass murderer John Lindley Frazier killed five members of a family in Santa Cruz, two separate serial murderers, Edmund Kemper and Herbert Mullen, began stalking that town at the same time. The combined victims of the three would reach 26. These statistics would prompt the district attorney, Peter Chang, to say that Santa Cruz has to be the murder capital of the world right now. Ensnaring his prey, an official parking sticker from the college aided Kemper, allowing him to use the college parking lots. And any student hitchhiker would naturally assume the person driving the car wasn't dangerous. After all, they went to the same school, didn't they? Indeed, even after a number of girls had been killed and co-eds been warned not to hitchhike, that parking sticker worked like a charm. Unsuspecting girls got into his car, and he said at the height of the co-ed killings, he even discussed the murders with the girls he picked up. He'd talk about who might be doing it and why, and he reported he gave these co-eds a free ride. For some reason, never killed any of the girls with whom he discussed the case. Well, he followed the classic pattern of the serial murderer. He worked from fantasy to fact. For a long time, he had fantasized about capturing women, holding a gun on them, and having his way with them. And ever so gradually, he began to act out parts of it. First, he put the gun under the seat when he was driving alone. Then he put it there when he picked up a hitchhiker and fantasized about what he's going to do to the girl. And finally, he pulled out the gun. And fantasy and fact became ghoulishly and murderously one. Well, one's irony is that the officers in the jury room bar and literally helped him kill. They gave him a pair of handcuffs, a realistic-looking police training badge. John Godwin reported that Kemper used the handcuffs to shackle the girls and put up resistance. It was a vicious turn of events that must have given more than one police officer a sleepless night. And then Kemper did something that apparently had a profound effect on his unconscious mind. He killed his mother. Later he would state that he realized his true rage was actually toward his mother. He felt that once he resolved this, he'd be able to stop killing symbols of his mother. In fact, after his mother's murder, he picked up a couple of girls instead of taking them to some lonely area to kill them, simply drop them off where they wanted to go. He took part in a documentary called Murder, No Apparent Motive, and in it he described the killing of his mother and At the time he was talking about it, he wept. Said he actually loved her, difficult as that was to imagine. He stated he didn't come out from under a rock, nor was he born to a mule. He came out of his mother. Well, Kemper said the last night of her life, his mother, whom he lived with at 609 Ord Street, was doing her usual emasculation, diminishing Kemper more and more. Her last words to him before she went to sleep were, "I guess you'll want to stay up all night talking." Well, when she fell asleep, he raised a ball-peen hammer above his head and brought it down on her skull, broke it like an eggshell. Then he beat her savagely to make sure she's dead. Then he cut off her hands and her head with his pocket knife, cut her larynx out, and ground it up in the garbage disposal. When asked why he did that, he said, "Now she won't be able to bitch at me anymore." And he had a good point. He stuffed the headless, handless corpse in a clothes closet and made a call to his mother's best friend, Ms. Halleck. He explained to Halleck he was going to have a surprise party for his mother and invited her over. That evening, Halleck came over and Kemper promptly strangled her to death and cut her head off as well. At a real party, I guess. Well, Kemper then left the area for Colorado, where he did something profoundly important. He called the police and told them he was the serial murderer they were looking for, that he'd killed his mother and her best friend. He told the police, "Pick me up and put me in jail now, or I'll go kill some more." Well, luckily for everybody concerned, his demand was taken seriously. It wasn't too long before they picked him up and brought him back to Santa Cruz. He was ultimately tried and sentenced to life imprisonment, serving all that time in a prison hospital. Kind of mental ward, I guess you could say, within the prison. Well, all this electronic stuff is well and good, but occasionally it doesn't work like it's supposed to. Unfortunately, I've got technical problems here. Our next serial killer is Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker. Well, 1983, there were 5 serial murders at large in Los Angeles. However, the most terrifying of all was the one that the media called the Night Stalker. And he was terrifying, no question about it. His M.O. was to invade homes in the middle of the night and leave dead bodies and blood all over the place when he left. He is believed to be responsible for the deaths of at least 16 people, maybe more. As the Sicamo serial killers, the extent of the danger wasn't known in the beginning. The first victim was a 79-year-old woman in Glacelle Park in June of 84. Then 8 months later, a 6-year-old Montebello girl was abducted from a bus stop. Her sexually abused body was found in Silver Lake on February 25th. Next victim of the Night Stalker was a 9-year-old girl, and for some reason, this pattern differed with this particular crime. He abducted her from her bedroom, raped her, and then dropped her off in Elysian Park, still living. Then on March 17th, the Night Stalker began a horrifying murder spree. He got into the condo of 34-year-old Dale Okazaki and Maria Hernandez, shot Okazaki to death and wounded Hernandez. Monterey Park, he pulled 30-year-old Sai Lian Liu from her car and shot her multiple times. She died the next day. While the Night Stalker was in the middle of abducting and raping a girl from Eagle Rock. But something good for the police did come out of this spree of violence. Hernandez, who survived the shooting, surprisingly enough, was able to provide a description. She said he had a long, gaunt face, black, stringy hair, and wide-spaced teeth that were brown and rotted out, which ultimately would be traced to the killer subsisting on candy. Police were still playing their cards close to the vest, not saying whether the murders were related or not. And then things got weirder. The Night Stalker invaded the home of Vincent Zazaria and his wife Maxine on March 27th. He beat Zazaria to death and his wife was stabbed. But the killer also cut the eyes of the woman and left with them in his pocket. Next, William Doy of Monterey Park was shot in the head, but his dying action of calling the police saved his wife. Over the summer, the Night Stalker killed 8 more people of varying ages. On August 6th, Christopher Peterson and his wife Virginia were wounded in a Northridge home. And then there were 2 more killings, and the description of the killer matched the description the Petersons gave of their attacker. Police finally announced they were looking for a serial killer who was responsible for quite a number of murders. And then the Night Stalker traveled to San Francisco and on August 17th broke into the house of Peter and Barbara Pan. Peter was shot and killed, and his wife survived the shooting, provided sketches to the police of the Night Stalker. Then the big break came. Michelle Viejo, which I'm quite familiar with, on August 22nd, 29-year-old Bill Carnes was shot in the head and his fiancée raped. And then the Night Stalker drove away in their car. Well, eventually, he abandoned the car, and the police got it along with the fingerprints. And the prints led police to 25-year-old Richard Ramirez, who was from Texas and had compiled a lengthy rap sheet for drug offenses. Police questioned people who knew him and learned he was an avowed Satanist who was crazed about the music group AC/DC, and one of the band's songs, Night Prowler, had become sort of an anthem for Ramirez. Well, the police spread his picture everywhere, and now the citizens had a face to go with the nickname. Foolishly, Ramirez decided to stay in L.A., where he had committed most of the murders. He wandered into East Los Angeles, where he was identified by Hispanic locals that he tried to steal a car from a parking lot that was being worked on. And he tried to run, and the mob ran him down and beat him half to death before the police arrived to save his life. He was held in jail and charged with 14 counts of murder. Well, if you look at his background, it's clear that he had the right childhood environment to produce a killer. The youngest of five children in a Mexican-American family and immigrated to the U.S. His father was a volatile man with a terrible temper. Richard kept to himself mostly, but when he was very young, in just the eighth grade, he started using marijuana and sniffing glue. Obviously, as anesthetics for living in a household where his father was such an unpredictable, disruptive force. He attended Theodore Roosevelt High School in the Boyle Heights section of Los Angeles, but quit in the ninth grade. His diet at the time that was leading to the horrendous condition of his teeth was junk food. It was a diet so rich in sugar it rotted his teeth and made his breath foul. And he continued to smoke marijuana and chalked up his first arrest for drug possession. He was also stealing and was arrested twice for stealing cars, first in Pasadena in 81, then in L.A. in 1984. His association with his cousin Mike added his development to a madman. Mike was a Vietnam veteran, member of the Special Forces, who showed Richard pictures of the killing and torturing of Vietnamese women. Ultimately, Mike murdered his wife while the 12-year-old Ramirez watched, an event that had a profoundly negative effect on Ramirez. Ramirez's trial that started July 22, 1988, took a full year. Finally, on September 30, 1989, he's found guilty of 13 counts of murder and 30 assorted felonies. On November 7, 1989, he was sentenced to death. And Ramirez didn't care. He said in court, "You maggots make me sick. You don't understand me. I'm beyond good and evil. I'll be avenged. Lucifer dwells in us all." Well, since he was convicted in the land of fruits and nuts, he's still sitting in San Quentin waiting to be executed. Well, our next one is Robert Hansen. Now, he was a strange one. Some investigators think he played a kind of hunt-and-kill game with his victims, turning them loose in the wilderness and hunting them down with a bow, an arrow, or a gun. And if he were murdering women today, the chances of him being caught would be a lot greater than they were in the early 1980s when he was finally tracked down. For one thing, films and books and television and other media made the average person much more aware of the existence of serial killers. For another, many people now know that serial killers often play on prostitutes. And prostitutes had complained about how Hansen had treated them long before he was apprehended, but the police doubted their credibility because they were prostitutes. Also, record keeping's a lot better now. Hansen's criminal record was revealing, but it was kept by separate police jurisdictions, and so it wasn't available for everybody who needed to know about it. And of course, there's the remarkable new investigative tool known as DNA. Bottom line, though, was that nobody put it all together before it was too late for Hansen's victims. And although he was a serial killer, he was not a wild-eyed hunchback monster slavering at the mouth. He was a wiry 5'10", 44-year-old who was married with children. lived in a log cabin on Old Harbor Avenue in Anchorage, Alaska, and he owned and operated a very successful bakery there. And he was even the object of sympathy. He had a severely pockmarked face, a remnant of his teen years when he suffered from very bad acne, and he stuttered. But, in spite of all that, he was also extremely dangerous. In the end, he admitted to having raped and killed 17 women, mostly dancers and prostitutes who worked the strip joints in Anchorage on 4th Street. But state troopers who investigated the case believed that Hansen actually killed a lot more. Glenn Foth, one of the state investigators, believed that Hansen killed 4 or 5 women a year from the early 70s till police tracked him down in 1984. He was raised in the tiny town of Pocahontas, Iowa. And his first recorded offense against the law was in 1960 when, at the age of 21, he and a friend set fire to the Pocahontas school bus garage, burned it to the ground, and destroyed 3 of the 7 school buses. Well, he would have gotten away with it, but his accomplice friend was seized with a surge of guilt over the act and confessed and pointed out that Hansen was his cohort. Well, for this act, he was sentenced to 3 years in the Iowa Men's Reformatory, which recommended psychiatric treatment. He spoke in a forthright way with the psychiatrist about his compulsion to set fires till one day in court he got a rude awakening. The prosecutors are using the information Hansen gave the doctors against him. Hansen said to himself, this is reported later in the Anchorage Daily News, "Oh, wait a minute, Bob, you fool, they suckered you, so right away I think, well, now, you know he never gonna make that mistake again." Well, he was paroled in May of 63, but had some more interactions with the law in Minnesota. He got picked up for shoplifting, an activity he'd been enjoying for a long time, and one that continued even after he started to kill. In a confession to police, he explained shoplifting aroused him sexually in some way. Once outside the store, many times he'd give away the stolen articles. The stealing itself was a reward enough. He wasn't incarcerated on the shoplifting charge. He'd been married for 1 year, and in 1967, married for the second time and moved to Anchorage, where he opened his bakery. His father had been a baker, in fact, the only one in Pocahontas, and Hansen learned to trade from him. Well, in November 71, Hansen was arrested. He was driving into town of Spinard, stopped for a light, and glanced over at the woman in the next car. She smiled at him, and he regarded this as an open invitation to point his gun at her, demand she come with him. Well, she didn't oblige him. He got released on his own recognizance, but while waiting trial, he was arrested again, this time accused of having picked up an 18-year-old prostitute outside a bar in downtown Anchorage, kidnapped her, and raped her at gunpoint. But in this particular case, the district attorney is forced to drop the case. The prostitute who filed the complaint failed to appear in court. Well, Superior Court Judge James Fitzgerald sentenced Hansen to 5 years for drawing the gun on the Spinard woman, basing the punishment heavily on psychiatric evaluation. Judge Fitzgerald could clearly see that Hansen was, in fact, dangerous. However, because of the way offenders like Hansen were treated in those days in Alaska, he got out of jail quickly, despite objections from the prosecutor. He had immediately applied for parole and was in jail only from March to June. In June, he was assigned to a halfway house where he received psychiatric treatment until November. In December, he was allowed to halfway house on a work furlough program. In the confession he gave to investigators later, he stated the very first night he was free, he went down to 4th Avenue in Anchorage and started cruising the area, watching prostitutes and fantasizing how he'd capture them again. Then he started to hang around the strip joints, trying to lure dancers and prostitutes with the promise of money for a good time. He was always flashing a big wad of money, which was tempting to some of the women, even though at the time many thought Hansen was definitely on the weird side. In 1975, another prostitute complained about Hansen to a rape crisis center, and the center reported the assault to the police. But Hansen was lucky. After a while, the woman refused to cooperate. See, prostitutes worry about talking to the police, and he wasn't charged, even though officers at the time were convinced he was guilty. Hansen, though, claimed that there was merely a dispute about money. Then in 1976, Hansen was picked up for shoplifting a chainsaw from a Fred Meyer store in Anchorage. This time, the law treated Hansen's offense severely because of his 2 previous felony convictions, the fire in Iowa and pointing his gun at the woman in Spinard. Judge sentenced him to 5 years. Sentence might have been harder if the judge had known of the two rape charges that had been filed against Hansen but thrown out. Well, Hansen appealed to the Alaska Supreme Court, arguing his sentence was excessive, and the court agreed, set him free in August of 78. In doing so, the court cited Hansen's apparently stable family life and his job. Other than his shoplifting and two prior felonies, the court believed Hansen lived a fairly normal life and thought that with psychiatric help, he'd be just fine. Recommended he be put on probation and treated, but the treatment never happened, and he was free to roam again. Also in 1978, he applied for a pilot's license. On his application, he stated he was taking lithium, a drug used to control bipolar disorder. And because of this, he was denied a license. In a subsequent application, he didn't list any drugs and was granted the pilot's license. Only one complaint on record against Hansen from that time until he was tracked down for murder. Complaint filed by, you guessed it, a prostitute. She claimed he held her hostage in his camper at Anchorage and that she had become convinced he was going to rape and kill her. Dude and desperate, she broke a window in the trailer and got out, ran down the street screaming as she went. Police got involved, but again, nothing came of the case. There was no physical evidence, and it came down to the word of a respected businessman against that of a prostitute. Well, Anchorage City Police and Alaskan State Police have been receiving complaints about missing topless dancers and others who frequented a strip joint scene on 4th Avenue. Complaints that they dismissed at first. I mean, let's face it, topless dancers tend to be a fairly transient group. When a few disappear, it doesn't necessarily mean foul play. They just may have gone on to greener pastures. Added up, though, the complaints were significant. Police realized that since 1980, six dancers had disappeared from the 4th Avenue clubs, and Anchorage police quietly formed what they called the Dancer Task Force to look into the disappearances. Then on September 13, 1982, a female body was discovered in a shallow grave by the Neek River in the wilds about 15 miles northwest of Anchorage. She had been shot once with a .223 caliber bullet. Shell casing was found nearby. Late September, the police got an ID for the victim. Her name was Sherry Morrow, and she was a dancer at the Wild Cherry Club who disappeared in November of 81. Well, with the discovery of this body, with a profile identical to that of the other missing women, the police department's fears that a serial killer was at work in Anchorage were confirmed. Well, since Morrow's body was found outside the jurisdiction of city police, the state and city police combined forces to develop a list of suspects. One of the most important things they did was question again and again the women on the 4th Avenue scene, women who'd been bothered at the clubs, who'd been approached and offered money. And one of the names that came up repeatedly in their questioning of these women was Robert Hansen. Then on June 13, 1983, a patrolman saw a 17-year-old prostitute running down 5th Avenue. She was handcuffed and screaming, clearly terrified. The patrolman, Greg Baker, tracked the woman through two motels and found her in one of them, still wearing the handcuffs. She said a man had taken her to his house and raped her. Baker found out about Hansen's criminal history and passed it on to the task force. Immediately, he became a prime suspect. And then something happened that made him the only suspect. The remains of Paula Goulding were found in a remote area near Neek River, about 20 miles north of Anchorage. That gravesite could not be reached by foot or vehicle, only by plane. And Robert Hansen was the only one of the suspects who owned and flew an airplane. Police gathered everything they could, and on October 22, 1983, brought him in for kidnapping and assault charges of the 17-year-old prostitute. Questioned him for 5 hours. And were convinced that they had their perp, not only in the kidnapping and assault, but also in the killings. But Hansen didn't confess, even though police were able to blow away his alibi. The wife of the friend who supplied him with an alibi said her husband had lied. Can't trust anybody anymore. Trial was held for the kidnapping and the assault while the investigation into the killings continued. Police armed with search warrants came up with some very damaging evidence against Hansen in his home, including an aeronautical map of South Central Alaska with 21 sites marked off, presumably for the graves of murder victims. There was a gun hidden under attic insulation that was eventually linked to the killings of two women, a bag of jewelry containing a distinctive necklace worn by one missing dancer, and business cards of two other missing dancers. These things, of course, were the trophies Hansen used to relive the killings. At one point, though, he finally gave it up, as the police would say.
He gave police a 12-hour confession, during which he admitted to killing 17 women and burying their remains in the wilds outside Anchorage. Took a plane ride with the police and pointed out the burial sites he remembered. During his confession, he went to great pains to rationalize his behavior. He said he would never kill good women, but prostitutes were something else. He'd kill them with impunity. He explained that he had had problems with women since he was a teenager in Iowa, and women wouldn't go out with him because of his acne and his stutter. He said he always loved women, but he made a distinction, a very clear distinction between good girls and bad girls. Bad girls, in his opinion, had to die. In the portion of his confession that followed, District Attorney Victor Crum is questioning Hansen, and it provides some insight into his mind. Crum said, "Why did you drive out to the road instead of just going to a hotel or motel in town?" And Hansen responded, "You know, if you go to a motel or something with it, it's more or less like a prostitution deal. I'd go and I guess I'm trying to even convince myself maybe I wasn't really buying sex is being given to me in the aspect that I was good enough that it was being given to me." If I'd explain it a little bit better, gentlemen, going back in my life, way back to my high school days and so forth, I was, I guess, what you might call frustrated, upset all the time. I could see my friends and so forth going out on dates and had a tremendous desire to do the same thing. And from the scars on my face, you can probably see, I could see why girls didn't want to get close to me. And when I'm nervous and upset, like I am here, I stutter. But at the time, during my junior high or high school days, I couldn't control my speech at all. I was always so embarrassed and upset with it from people making fun of me that I hated the word school. Guess that's why I burned down the bus way back in Iowa. Well, he went on at great length to justify his acts, I guess you could say. In the spring of 1990, Robert Hansen was moved from the Lemon Creek Prison in Juneau, Alaska, to the maximum security facility at Spring Creek in Seward. It's about 120 miles southwest of Anchorage. And it was discovered that Hansen was collecting materials, including aeronautical maps that indicated he was planning to try to escape from Lemon Creek. More than one investigator thinks he would kill many more women he admitted to. He, as I said earlier, played a kind of a hunt-and-kill game with them, releasing them into the wilderness and hunting them down with a bow and arrow or a rifle. Some killers have something likable about them. You might call them monsters with charm. But according to ex-major Walter Gilmore of the Alaska State Police, there were no redeeming qualities about Hansen, and a number of others have reflected Gilmore's sentiments. The house where Hansen lived on Old Harbor Avenue is still there. Don't have any information on who's living in it now. Well, our next serial killer is a man named Harvey Glattman. He's reminiscent of a character often seen in B-movies. Looked like a harmless nerd, a baggy face, bespeckled, slow-lidded young man. But beneath his exterior was a sharp. His IQ measured when he was in San Quentin was 130. That was almost at a genius level. But despite all this intelligence, something was clearly wrong with Harvey even at an early age. When he was 12, his mother noticed red welts on his neck. When she asked what caused him, he said he'd tied a rope around his neck and was hanging from it. He said torturing himself in that way gave him pleasure. In 1945, at the age of 17, he started grabbing women's purses, running away and tossing the purses back. He was more interested in scaring the women than he was in robbing them. And his predilection escalated further that same year when he was in Boulder, Colorado. Pulled a toy gun on a young woman and asked her to disrobe. She screamed and he ran, but the girl later picked him out of a lineup and he got arrested. Well, he didn't hang around for trial. He fled to the East Coast. There he was caught up in a robbery and the authorities learned he was a fugitive wanted in Boulder. Well, he was sentenced to 5 years in Sing Sing. 1951, he was released from prison and headed for the West Coast, settling in Los Angeles. Became a repairman in the television repair business that was just getting off the ground, and he had a hobby, photography. All appearances, he appeared to have assumed his place in the community, had a job with responsibilities, a place to stay, and a hobby. Of course, nothing was further from the truth. He was getting ready to kill. Well, you know, Pierce Brooks was a Los Angeles detective who founded the Violent Criminal Apprehension Program, or VICAP. Eventually computerized, and it had files on solved and unsolved violent crimes, so investigators anywhere could study them for similarities. And the inspiration for this, the creation of this program, was Harvey Glattman. Brooks had had a terrible time trying to check similarities among Glattman's murders, and he convinced his superiors to create it for future use, and it turned out to be very useful. Well, Glattman developed some methods for capturing women that seemed like scenes from the movies. Not real life. It didn't seem like they could really happen, but they did. For instance, in 1957, under the alias of Johnny Glenn, he made a television repair service call on the home of Judy Dahl. Dahl was a very pretty, recently married 19-year-old. When Glattman learned she was a model, he told he was a part-time photographer and asked whether she wanted to be interested in a job. He explained that a New York City detective magazine hired him to take one of the women in Jeopardy photos, a girl bound and gagged. If she accepted, he said he'd pay her $50. She agreed. On August 1st, 1957, he picked her up and took her to the what he called his photography studio. Once in the car, he pulled a gun on her and said that she was to obey him or he'd kill her. Took her to his apartment where he forced her to strip and took photos of her. Then he raped her and told her to get dressed, tied her up, put a gag in her mouth, took some more photos. The photos he took are not overly obscene. Her dress was pulled up above her knees, and, of course, she was bound and gagged. It's interesting to note that he was a virgin until he was 29 when he raped his first victim. Then he forced her into the car and drove about 125 miles out in the desert near the town of Indio, took some flash photos, and used a rope to strangle her. Then he buried her in a shallow grave, but the wind ultimately blew the sand off of her, and her skeleton got discovered. He enlarged those photos of the terrified woman and mounted them on his wall as kind of a memorial. The second ploy involved him becoming a member of a Lonely Hearts Club, the potential predator women were always warned about when they joined one of these clubs. It's kind of the equivalent of online dating today. Then using the alias George Williams, he met a woman named Shirley Bridgeford. Told her he was a plumber. They hit it off, made a date, and he told her to be sure to dress for the occasion. He was going to take her to an exclusive dance club. Once he had her in the car, he sped out toward the Borrego, now Anza Borrego Desert State Park near San Diego, which is 55 miles away. Out there in the darkness, with only the stars as witnesses, he raped her repeatedly. Afterward, he tied her up and shoved a gag in her mouth and took photos of the crying woman. Like the photos of Dahl, the photos of Bridgeford were more suggestive than obscene. And he raped her again and then strangled her, left her body out in the open to be decomposed and be eaten by the animals. Well, we're going to talk more about Mr. Glattman on Monday, but we've run out of time for today. So until Monday, the same time, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great weekend.